Hello and welcome to Timber Sycamore.
It's your host with the most.
And
the least.
Welcome back to Timber Sycamore, where we are still talking about Afghanistan.
Our next point of business, point of order, I believe, is the beginning of U.S. involvement in earnest and the Chinese connection.
So the U.S. involvement in earnest, the Soviet Union picks up on it in 81.
Mm-hmm.
It really begins before that, right? So by the time that the U.S. formally authorizes $14.5 million in aid, which is $14.5 million in cash, right? Because that's an important distinction. Cash gives these groups the ability to do whatever they would like. Prior to that, we have given $4.5 million in military supplies. The Soviet Union notices this and begins to get a little bit concerned. Understandably, right? Because nobody really wants the U.S. fucking around in another country. The Soviet Union has already been through Vietnam. They've seen some of the Latin American situation develop. And now are in a position where they're about to watch the U.S. get involved in Afghanistan.
They've picked up on the trends in U.S. intelligence by this point.
Yeah. In your country, they're going to do some war crimes. Not that the Soviet Union is particularly taking a soft line towards committing war crimes, but there's a degree that can be carried out by the U.S. that the U.S. populace seems to be less concerned about than the Soviet populace.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I don't actually think that that's probably the issue here. The issue is that it's a lot easier to just destroy a country to make sure someone can't have it outright than it is to reconstruct a country in line with the rest of Europe's sphere, which is the Soviet goal. The Soviet goal is to have a functioning democratic Afghanistan. Democratic,
yes.
And Soviet democracy, yes, but like a functioning Afghanistan so that they can be integrated into the rest of the Soviet sphere, a la the Eastern Bloc in general. The United States, conversely, is only interested in making sure that the Soviets can't have Afghanistan.
Right. If the U.S. cannot have Afghanistan, then the Soviet Union cannot either.
Which is why we see that's probably the bigger factor in the difference of tactics here. Whether, you know, American penchant for war crimes is also a factor is a topic of some contention for further debate.
I think it's that the American populace is in part more willing to accept a certain level of severity in war. Especially,
I think that's entirely speculative, I'll be honest.
It's speculative, but especially at this point. Well, at this point, we are probably at a low point for our willingness to tolerate that in a war.
This is post-Vietnam.
Yeah, we have just come out of Vietnam. People are not super keen on the idea of a full-scale military engagement.
Whether that be for, you know, opposition to the human suffering that it causes or if it's a more isolationist kind of reaction.
Right. Either way, people don't love it. So the U.S. starts off by engaging in a very limited sense in September 81 with cash and supplies and some training. So there's training that's being provided by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, MI6, the U.S., West Germany has already tried their hand. They trained the king's prison, the king's police. That didn't work out for them. So they understand what their role is now in international relations a little bit better, which is you are inferior to the United States.
I believe they would call that harsh but fair, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very German way to understand A very German understanding of international relations. So we start dropping off a couple things. Small arms are the obvious, right? Because you need something to compete with an AK. Unless you are gathering your weapons from the Soviet Union, which...
In which case you have AKs, so...
And which is a very common thing. There's a huge number of military defectors, which the Soviet Union was always concerned of and always kind of aware of.
But that there's, also is... there's also the strategy of, there's also Massoud's strategy of being able to, like obtain these arms through guerrilla tactics.
Yeah, there's also some, like... weird back channels running from countries that are very soon to become Soviet, ex-Soviet countries. And also the countries that are about to become Balkanized. Right? Like, it is not a coincidence that the Balkan Mujahideen and the Afghan Mujahideen are 80% of the same people. and committing 100% of the same crimes. So the U.S. realizes that the U.S. government is not going to be providing us with all of the money we need. The CIA takes a lot of money to operate. Now, they hide that money in places like Inkytel, which means that they don't have to found CIA fronts anywhere near as often to make money with. Inkytel is our venture capital firm for the CIA. They are allowed to run with a black budget every year. And all of the money they make seems to go back into the CIA. Nobody can confirm it, but it never seems to be reinvested anywhere. So, you know, functionally, that is a CIA front organization just for the sake of turning profits and developing technology, right? That doesn't exist yet. So what we do is we outfit people like Goldblatt and Hekmatyar with...
I guess... Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, it seems like... have you ever complained about your tax dollars being used for CIA ops in the Middle East? Not technically true. They have other means of funding them now.
Yeah, they go through venture capital.
There you go.
You
don't even get a say anymore.
Yeah, it's not even your tax dollars.
Not even your money. Unless you're buying flights from Air America or something.
Routinely. Yeah. Unless you're doing $1 million in Air America flying every year.
You got to get those loyalty points, you know.
Fly Delta. It's better. And they've never once been a CIA front as far as we know yet.
Fly Southwest because I got the good peanuts.
I usually fly... whatever's cheapest, honestly.
Yeah, you ain't got the card. I'm sure Laura's got one.
Laura flies Delta.
Does she have the Delta card?
She does not, but she does have Delta status.
Well, yeah, she's got the that is the Delta card. She's a Delta female.
Delta female with a Sigma grind set.
Yeah, there you go.
So. They start off with small arms, which are the obvious one. The one that has the most long-lasting impact, and we have learned this, at this point, the U.S. is intimately aware of this, is mines.
Hearts and mines?
Nope. Landmines.
Oh, mines in the ground. I see.
At one point, Goldblatt and Hekmatyar says that a landmine is his favorite weapon.
Go on.
Because other ones inflict casualties, but landmines make you afraid to leave your front door.
That makes sense.
He's not incorrect. Landmines are an incredibly effective psychological warfare tool. Notoriously, the UN a couple years ago voted against declaring landmines a U.S. war crime. Or a war crime in general.
Yeah. Like, you can't do like ex post facto, but yeah. So they decided not to do that, though.
Yeah, the U.S. used their Security Council veto for it.
Nice. USA.
USA, yeah. At the same time as they use their Security Council veto, because a lot of other countries in the world are very upset about landmines being used in their country, there was so the exact same day that the vote is happening, there was an art exhibit that included plastic limbs from children who were hit by not one, but two landmines. So the first one took a limb and the second one took their life. On the same day that the US used its Security Council veto to make sure that that could continue to happen.
And when was this?
Mid-2000s. I have a friend who was working at the UN at the time. Sorry, Michael's spooked up. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. The connections. It's all coming together.
I'll text him now and see if he answers.
You get to see quote-unquote research in real time, should you be so lucky.
Yeah, this is us reaching out to sources. Yeah. Like real journal. Sorry, yeah, let me check our source. Let me check our source. My neighbor.
Yeah, I get the conspiracy guy on the podcast. We would have such a fun time with him. Current affairs.
So let me tell you how Michael has a ex-girlfriend who he moved in with to live next door to a UN agent. She was a Freemason.
It all comes back to Douay, doesn't it?
Fucking schizophrenia mind going nuts right now.
This is the most schizophrenic podcast on the internet right now. 100%. Oh, yeah, you flashes a little bit. Yeah, we see it.
He said it was 2013.
2013. Okay.
So the landmines become particularly effective in terms of losing hearts and minds warfare, right? Which is part of the goal of guerrilla warfare, is to make the other side want to just stop fighting.
It's demotivating.
Yeah.
It's demoralizing, rather.
Yeah. Yeah. Demotivating is the posters.
Yeah.
So at the time, the US and Jordan were the only countries that were opposed to it.
Why Jordan?
Because Jordan was a U.S. puppet state at the time. Well, a Saudi puppet state.
But the Saudis didn't oppose it.
Well, the Saudis didn't officially oppose it. They abstained.
They abstained? Oh.
Yeah. Oh, Q messaged me.
You get to see all the internal shenanigans on this.
He asked me to call him in like an hour.
All right, we got to wrap this up then.
So we're going to move into Sigma grind set mode. All right, so September of 1980, the U.S. is dropping chemical weapons off. September of 81, the Soviet Union realizes that the U.S., Saudi Arabia, MI6, and Egypt are training these groups. They're
so
dropping...
The 4-month war, like, a fantasy is over, surely.
Yeah. No.
No. Okay, cool.
So the Soviet Union still believes that this war is just around the corner. It's going to be done.
Okay.
The U.S. is dropping these off in C-130s, which are the planes that we have mentioned before that are flying in. They're military transit planes with all of the passenger seats chopped off, and then they just load boxes onto them. They don't even strap them down. That's like a really significant point that's made, is that the one CIA... intel agent, when he gets on the plane, because he is visibly uncomfortable, like he is standing on a plane with a bunch of boxes of ammunition and explosives, and the pilot looks at him and says, "Don't worry, I've never crashed one."
Yeah, I feel better.
And he said, "Ever?" And he said, "Well, not in Afghanistan." Which is, I guess, supposed to be comforting, but this man is on a plane filled with Stinger missiles, landmines, and explosives, as well as like cases of ammunition. If this plane goes up, it's going up. They're just flying this in as low as they can, skimming the ground and unloading cases of ammunition. CIA agents used to have to jump out of them with parachutes on because they would not stop to land. Because whenever they get where they're going, they have to look like a real plane.
Right.
So this
Minus all the passenger seats.
Right. Yeah. No, like a normal cargo plane.
Why not just use a regular cargo plane?
So that's what C-130s used to be, is cargo planes. So when you rip all the seats out, it looks like a cargo plane. It just has like hand straps in for where the CIA agents are supposed to be holding themselves on for this entire event. It is an incredibly unsafe way to travel. And in theory, like if these boxes fall wrong, they could also just go up while you're landing, right?
Yeah, they could go off at any time.
We are just pushing cases of landmines out of the back of a plane.
It's like the air version of Sorcerer.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So the U.S. starts providing all of this to them. They start providing training. And then in 82, shit hits the fan.
What happens?
So the PRC has up until now taken a kind of non-committance.
Non-committal stance.
Yeah, they've been sitting in between, like, well, we don't really want the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, but we don't want to have to take sides in Afghanistan. Understandably.
It's a shit show. You wouldn't want to be involved in any capacity, surely.
Right. If you're a government, you are not jumping at the fucking opportunity to be like, oh, we should send troops to Kabul.
I mean, especially because, like, the Chinese at least recognize that, like, you know, their opposition to the Soviets is not of the same nature as the American opposition. Like, they are not in favor, I think, of, like, destroying Afghanistan entirely just to prevent the Soviets from having it. And at the same time, there's no scenario in which Afghanistan leaves this becoming a Chinese ally. So there's really, you would think
Afghanistan is a Chinese ally until 79.
Let's talk about that. When does that start? Because it was my understanding that that it had also been an ally of the Soviet Union pretty much up until the war.
Well, Afghanistan is solidly in the non-aligned category.
Yeah,
in the same way that, like, you know, Cuba is in the non-aligned category, right?
Yeah.
Like, are they non-aligned? Yes. If push comes to shove, are we pretty sure we know who they're siding with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the country that's training all of the military officers in the 50s and the 60s, almost certainly.
Yes. So there is at least some sense that Afghanistan up until then. So in 78, all of the Chinese specialists leave. In 79, all of the Chinese representatives in total leave. By 82, Zhao Ziyang declares opposition to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Which is a huge step from, like, hey, I'm pulling my diplomats out of a war zone, right?
Yeah.
Countries pull diplomats from war zones. That's a reality of what they do. You don't then say, hey, by the way, I'm opposed to you being here. That is a foreign policy stance versus, like, a self-interested stance. By this time, the Soviet Union has realized that China is going to oppose them in Afghanistan, and in more than a nominal way.
Like with real material backing to this.
In 82, Zhao Ziyang issues the statement that we will back them financially, materially, politically, and morally.
And this is for the Mujahideen.
Correct.
Nice.
And they, yeah. Right, great. Doing awesome, guys.
I mean, after we have talked about a little bit about the early Massoud, it's a little bit easier to see why these kinds of, like, this foreign policy decision makes more sense at the time than it does in hindsight.
Yes. Yeah, like, we don't realize how all of these people are going to end up.
I mean, what's weird is that it's like a kind of double edge. It's like a double reversal. When you hear initially as a, you know, like a little baby communist that the United States, did you know the United States funded the Mujahideen rebels in Afghanistan? It was not the case that you imagine that they funded everybody who was exactly like the Taliban. You study the Mujahideen and discover they are not all like the Taliban, and then study further and find out, oh, but the CIA did fund exclusively the ones that were like the Taliban.
Right, like if they could find the most vicious guy around, that was the one.
So it's like you have this double reversal. It's like, well, not all the Muj were like the Taliban. Just the ones the CIA funded. You know?
Right. Yeah. Some of them were perfectly reasonable, like Afghan nationalists who just wanted the Soviet Union to fuck off.
Well, until
those people don't get money.
Until the Afghan Civil War, then they also become just as odious.
Yeah. Right. So. For a decade, they're like your best choice though. So by this point in time, it is pretty well known that basically the rest of the world, other than the Soviets, have admitted that this is going to be longer than a 4-month war. The Soviets still have a vested interest in maintaining that lie, at least to themselves.
Motivated reasoning. It's insidious.
China was very tolerant of the idea of Afghanistan being there for a couple months and restoring civility, right? Mm-hmm. Like, China has a vested interest here, but it is by far secondary to U.S. interests and even Soviet interests. Like, again, like you said, there is no world where China is coming out with them as a primary ally.
Yeah, so the Chinese, like, vested interest in Afghanistan, short of actually committing genocide, is limited.
Right, because they might get a soft ally. Like, they will have another Cuba as a trading partner.
Mm-hmm.
Which is valuable.
Immensely, for a country like Afghanistan.
Right. And for China, it would be very valuable to have an Afghanistan on their side.
Not slowing down on the drinks, are we?
This is not alcoholic.
Oh, never mind. So you have had no alcohol today, then?
It's a Malta.
He has not answered the question, you will notice.
I had a gimlet during our meeting with Q.
We are doing terribly as far as the... We are not very good Muslims here.
Interestingly, Massoud starts to make some statements that are found very controversial amongst the Mujahideen here.
Let's hear him.
So he starts to say things like, this repressive brand of Islam is not what the Afghani people want.
The repressive form of Islam being... Okay. So Taliban-style Islam is not what the people want, so claims Massoud.
Well, until at least 96.
At which point does he drop it?
Well, at which point he wins out over the Taliban. Until 2001, you know, when he dies. Masood and Rabbani both die right on either side of 9/11.
Nice.
One dies September 9th, the other dies October 14th. Rabbani dies immediately after he calls for the declaring carrying out a suicide bombing takfir.
Which you would think would be natural, like for any sufficiently Islamist organization. Life is a precious gift. You do not achieve the inner struggle of jihad through ending your own life. That seems ridiculous. That's
right. Like the greater jihad.
We are real Islamic scholars here.
The greater jihad is always the struggle towards self-enlightenment and self-improvement. Towards leading a more moral life. That said, Rabbani is an octogenarian married to a teenager. Mm-hmm. So again, like we're operating on a skewed moral scale here, kind of.
I mean, you know. Okay, sure.
Not to give, like, the age gap discourse people credit.
I'm French. I have to defend the old man and the teen girl a little bit.
But a guy in his 80s should not be... It's a contractual obligation.
As per my ethnic obligation, you know.
It's contractual as well now.
What if it was, like, a Serge Gainsbourg type deal? What if he was, like, just, like... What if he just had an aura that she liked?
What if it was, like, a Charles Manson type deal? He just had an aura that she liked.
Serge Gainsbourg was cooler, though, so.
Charles Manson's a manlet.
That's not cool.
You two are the same height.
We are not. No way. Fuck you.
He's 5'7".
No, you're I'm 5'8". Fuck off.
Sorry, Charles Manson and Suda are the same height.
That's a lie. I like that one a lot. Serge's height?
I don't know.
We'll look that up.
Is there a relationship between being very short as a man and dating young women?
Yes, there is. Do you want to know what it is?
What?
Well, like, again, women want someone who's taller than them, but you can't always be taller than them. Sometimes you're a short guy. Hold on, I'm not finished. You date a young woman because you are spiritually taller than her.
I thought you were going real young.
I'm not that short. Come on. I'm like an inch below average height in the U.S. And we're all really short here because of the lack of nutrients.
In Houston?
No, compared to Europe.
Oh, I thought you meant in Houston.
No, average size in Houston's people here are taller, but like a lot of people are also fat.
Fair.
There's no shortage of nutrients here in Houston. I promise you.
Wow, Bolivia has the tallest city in the world. Oh, that's by height. Like above sea level. Which does make them all look taller, because when they're standing up on a mountain, they all look real big.
All right, where were we?
Sorry, I'm making wholesome jokes, Hayes. I'll stop.
No, I'm just wanted to get back to where we were.
So the Chinese government issues this statement offering moral support, and then they set up bases in a location that will later become very relevant for China, Xinjiang.
Hey, we got there.
So this is accompanied by Deng Xiaoping cracking down on local practice of Islam. Because Salafists don't love like folk Islam in the same way that like the Vatican does not love folk Catholicism, but they allow it. But Salafists don't allow it. So part of this agreement is that they stop this practice of what is culturally like a combination of Sufi Islam,
which is the cool
and
kind.
Yeah. So some combination of Sufi Islam and folk Islam, like where they are declaring like folk saints, which again Salafists are opposed to, just because they're saints more than anything else. And like folk practices in general, which the Salafists are opposed to because, I don't know, the noble honored dead don't support it. The result is that what takes hold in Xinjiang is Salafist Islam, which really comes back to bite China in a couple of years. And at this time, really, really comes back to bite Afghanistan. So these dudes are coming out and they are well-trained guerrilla soldiers, right? Because China has experience fighting a guerrilla war. This is the Taylor's still being involved in the government, who are certainly experienced in guerrilla warfare. And the result is that these dudes come out pretty fucking good at it. China doesn't care particularly which sect of the Mujahideen you are from. Mm-hmm. The result is a hard split between China and the Soviet Union that already existed becoming intensified. And China using this to somewhat cynically, I would say, prop itself up as the defender of the third world against the mutual imperialist powers of the US and the Soviet Union. Which is not to say that China never acts in that role.
China's foreign policy during this period is very famously schizophrenic.
Yes, and in this particular case, very bad. So by 82, we have an alliance of multiple emerging powers and the US government against the Soviet Union, who kind of has the feeling of being like, they have like the appearance of being the team captain that got to pick last at gym class, because their only ally in this is Afghanistan.
It's one way of putting it. Maybe indicative of some past resentment, but that's okay.
Well, like they have the whole of the Soviet bloc as their allies.
Yeah. The B team of Europe.
The B team of Europe that could have invaded Europe fairly easily at one point, to be fair.
No, that's... Yeah, they get that much credit. Absolutely.
They are...
We were so lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when they were capable of invading Europe. So someone made a point to me one time to mention that part of the Soviet fall from being like the dominant left-wing power in the world, which I think becomes relevant again here, with how long the war goes on for. The most honest and sincere people in the Soviet Union lined up to fight for the revolution. They then lined up to fight in Spain. They then lined up to fight in World War II. And by the 50s, you're left with Khrushchev.
There was just nobody left at that point.
I mean, out of the like sincere and experienced leadership. Because it's important to note, like, we're talking leaders here. We're not talking, like, the dude on the factory floor who's probably a good organizer.
Yeah.
And might be a very effective leader.
We're talking about leadership.
Right. And Afghanistan has a similar problem. So, like, Afghanistan has their first openly communist insurrection in the 20s. They then are at war almost constantly in some form or another until the 80s.
Where they are still at war until today.
Yes. So in some cases, it could be that these people were, like, there were very sincere actors. There were very good actors. And by the time we're talking about, that doesn't exist anymore, really. What we have are people who are power hungry and manipulative and in many cases vicious. Operating on all sides of this. And in the case of China, it is very similar in that they go from World War II to the revolution, to Korea, to Vietnam. They're constantly struggling against imperialists. So this is not to slander the communist revolutionaries of any of these countries, right? Because these people, I know you said there's no heroes, but these people made very heroic sacrifices. And the same is true for the Afghani populace, whether they wanted it to be or not, in a lot of cases. The Afghani populace, unfortunately, much like the Soviet populace during World War II, gets forced into the position of being heroic. Which invariably means that there will be some people who answer that call and some people who won't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it complicates things when we look at things that way. There are no heroes in this story. There are no, like, great evils in this story, except for the ones that are very obvious. The ones who truly are going out of their way to make things unpleasant. Is Massoud a hero? No. Is Massoud a villain? Not really. Is the Soviet Union a hero? Definitely not. Is the Soviet Union a villain? Not really. But the people who are willing to extend hands and build bridges, which I'm going to broadly include Massoud in that category.
Right.
Because at the very least, at one point, he does reach out to the Soviet government or Soviet-backed government and make the point that until Gulbuddin Tekmachev is put down, this war can't keep going between us. So
Massoud is that opposed to to Tekmachev just as... just for his practices.
Yes.
That is an incredible buried lead in the story, I think. Because again, like I said, when we talk about the Mujahideen, it's typically referred to as if it's a sort of completely homogenous group of people. That does not seem to be the case. It seems to be the case that there was so much internal strife that one of them was willing to ally with the Soviets over another part of the Mujahideen.
Massoud calls a 19-month ceasefire with the Soviet government to fight Gulbuddin Tekmachev. Which is not an insignificant amount of this war. Like, it's a 10-year war for almost, for 19 months of it. He's at a year and a half.
Now, Tekmachev had previously been reporting Massoud's location to the Soviets, so there had been some sabotage coming from the other side as well before this point.
Yes. Gulbuddin Tekmachev is the only Mujahideen group's leader that issues a formal statement to his men that if you want to win, we will sell out and destroy other Mujahideen groups. So there's a comment made by an American official who says that the goal of Afghan warfare to this point in their history has largely been to end conflict. Right? People were willing to sit down and talk with each other or call for a loya jirga, right, as the case may be, with the understanding that certain people at certain times will have differing opinions. This is not the case with Goldblum and Heckmajar. It's specifically why the U.S. singles him out for support. Because Goldblum and Heckmajar...
completely uncompromising. There's no,
he wants to win.
There's no risk of him making a peace deal with the Soviets.
Yeah, the Saudi intelligence actually makes the point at one point that Goldblum and Heckmajar refuses to meet with Ronald Reagan.
Why?
Because his argument is that he will not be seen with the head of America when he is waging war against both the Soviets and America. And that it would discredit him in front of his peers, which is true, of course. And Prince Turki bin Prince Turki al-Faisal bin Saud basically calls him a nut job for this. He's like, yeah, no, he's right. It will be discrediting. But the guy's got to learn how to play the fucking game a little bit. In retrospect, it looks like this was very much a staged refusal.
You think so?
I find it hard to believe otherwise because Reagan doesn't like address it publicly.
I disagree. Is this not exactly what, like, the fact that he refused to meet with Reagan is probably, is that not further evidence that they had chosen the right guy for the job? Like, it's entirely, I'm not saying that I think it is for sure not staged, but that it's, there's a reasonable chance that it wasn't staged.
It could be a bit of column A, a bit of column B, too.
Well, it was staged, but it wasn't staged, or?
It was staged, but it was staged on one side and not on the other.
So the United States, like, in bad faith, extended the invitation.
Yes, because American Intel knew he was uncompromising.
Because they knew he was uncompromising, he wouldn't accept.
Yes, and it puts them in a position where they can then say, no, see, he's sincerely fighting for Afghanistan.
Yes, he wants nothing to do with America.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a bad point.
I am sure that there are intelligence operatives who were on the ground in Kabul who would have told American Intel, like, he's not going to come meet with Reagan.
I feel like it's probably, you again, it's not hard to guess that this would be his position at this point.
Right, because he is at that point giving a speech to Congress about why the Mujahideen needs support. He never speaks to any senator individually.
How does he never speak to senators typically?
No, like while he's like, even when he's giving this discussion, refuses to shake hands, refuses to be friendly towards them. Like gives his speech about like the Soviets are torturing us and ba 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 ba. And of course, like, you know, fucking irony of Goldblum and Heckmajar accusing anyone of being a torturer is lost on the American senators who have no idea what's going on in Kabul. Or in any of the Pashtun, like native Pashtun regions, where Heckmajar's army is the strongest and he's functionally press ganging people into it. Right? Because, like we said, these reforms, quote unquote, are not popular. Like, even the majority of the reforms that are implemented by Daoud Khan or by the king, Zahir Shah, they are not particularly unpopular reforms as long as they don't fuck with people's money.
And we've made this point on previous episodes where we discussed the background. That these right. reform, that the idea that it's some kind of social conservatism that is motivating, like, reaction against the communist government is, it seems to be entirely bullshit.
Yeah, no, it is 100% lies, basically. And Goldblum and Heckmajar is in every way the most conservative socially of these groups, which means that his reforms are even less popular than the rest of theirs. Goldblum and Heckmajar is throwing acid on women before he's in the Mujahideen. Like, he's just a professor, and he would throw acid on women in his classes.
Must have had excellent tenure. I don't know.
They really, really liked him in Pakistan, so. But what we don't see is this kind of social conservatism that he is embracing and that he is at the spearhead of. So what ends up happening is he realizes nobody gives a fuck about his reforms. And like even the Saudi leadership admits that, oh, well, you know, he is a harsh disciplinarian. That's always how they word it. He's a harsh disciplinarian of his men. Which only tells half the story, because that is a true statement. But what it ignores is most of his men are not well-disciplined because they hate him. They are terrified of him. Reading their descriptions of him, it sounds like they're talking about the fucking movie Blood In, Blood Out. Like, the Saudis are sitting there and they're like, well, when you join Hekmatyar's organization, it can be difficult to leave. Which is one of those things that you don't ever want to hear someone say about your government.
No. No, not at all.
Like, when you join it, it's hard to join the U.S. Army and leave. Well, I mean, yeah, you put in your time and you get out. There's none of that option with Hekmatyar. Either you're in for a penny, in for a pound, baby. And in his case, a pound is a pound of flesh all the time.
Could be a pound of heroin. We don't know.
Yeah.
Did that too.
So
did we talk about the drug trafficking?
No, but we should.
Yeah, that's content.
Briefly.
Oh, by the way, I just looked it up. Hekmatyar is still alive.
Yeah, I know.
Masoud died in 2001.
Yeah, September 9th.
But Hekmatyar is still kicking.
Yeah, the only debatably reasonable person in this whole story gets killed on September 9th.
Didn't even get to see the final, like the big bang of Mujahideenism.
Yeah, he missed the bulk of the Taliban. Also, the Taliban are really in shadow.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I have no idea. They wear eyeshadow and, like, that's like a thing. They were, like, notorious for it.
The emos? They, like, the goth? Goth,
well,
Islam?
So that's how Masoud started to notice them first, because Masoud was the first person to be like, hey, CIA, those guys, I'm pretty sure they're the Mujahideen. Like, that's Hekmatyar's group. I know it. I just pointed directly at Laura, who just walked in the house, to say that. Her. She is Taliban.
Laura's the Taliban?
Yeah, Laura's the Taliban.
Laura, how could you? I thought you were a feminist.
Say, Hayes says he thought you were a feminist. How are you in the Taliban? I got the floor, babe. I haven't cleaned the whole freezer out. That's why I didn't do it.
Look at this very trite domestic life he's living over here.
So there's like observations that the Taliban are coming back, that they are the Muj in disguise. Specifically that they are Gulban Hekmatyar in disguise. Like, seemingly all of them. They're really into eyeshadow and really into warfare. But they also have something else that attaches them to Gulban Hekmatyar, which is that they are super into processing and distributing heroin. So Gulban Hekmatyar has a unique situation with the United States. Unique in the sense that he gets three pharmaceutical grade labs to produce heroin. This is a side effect of the CIA realizing that they were not going to be able to, like, fully fund the Mujahideen in spite of their now blossoming budget. By 84, you know, the budget is close to $200 million a year. So, like, we can start question maybe why that much money is necessary to fund an army, especially in, like, a third world country. There's the eyeshadow.
Why? Has anyone figured this out?
Why are the Taliban super into it? I don't know, because their name is the Students.
Students of what?
Students of the Cure.
Of the Cure, like Robert Smith?
Yeah. the Wooden Hekmatyar becomes the largest heroin distributor in the Golden Triangle.
The Golden Triangle, again, being...
Or Golden Crescent, sorry.
The Golden Crescent being...
So, Golden Triangle refers to Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia. The Golden Crescent is Afghanistan, Pakistan, and one other country. But it is the region that poppies grow natively.
Not Iran?
Iran might be included, but Iran never has, like, the same level of heroin distribution.
It is Iran.
Is it?
Yep.
They just don't have the same level of poppy distribution post-Shah. Like, they don't have CIA-backed heroin dealers. Which hurts your market there.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to everyone, but from here on out, everywhere we talk about is going to have CIA-backed drug dealers.
I'm ready. Let's go.
So Gulbuddin Hekmatyar develops contacts with other CIA-backed drug dealers, specifically the Albanian mafia, who are only just beginning to burgeon.
The Albanian mafia is itself a very interesting story, I think.
Yeah, especially considering they don't develop until the mid-80s.
So very weird. Late to the game, better late than never.
Late to the game, but a strong contender.
Strong contender. They're like Verlander, you know? Give up the first few innings, but then afterwards, just a powerhouse.
Yeah. But specifically, they have attachments to the Corsican Mafia.
You should be forgiving for thinking Corsica doesn't have a mafia, because who lives in Corsica? But
so
the Corsican Mafia is also the name for the Napoleonic Brigades.
Is it?
No. I made that up.
Oh.
That was a joke.
I wasn't sure.
He's the Corsican ogre. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I knew that. I wasn't sure if they called it the Corsican Mafia when he was running it.
I'm not sure mafia... Was mafia even a term that they used very frequently in the 19th century?
It would have been used for, like, a secret society.
Probably not applicable then.
Yeah, Napoleon didn't do much in secret.
Well, not the brigades. Never mind. Whatever.
The world's first true advertising expert. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not. You're right. I was nodding.
So the Corsican Mafia is founded for a while, but rises to prominence under the patronage of the first head of the DEA's special services.
Being?
Lucien Conin, who is called Black Luigi.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Black Luigi.
So Black Luigi is an OSS agent. He's a former French citizen who, for whatever reason, joins the OSS during World War II and does not do anything with the French resistance. Instead, he goes to Corsica to deal with the Corsican Mafia.
You know, I'm pretty sure last time I went to a flea market, I saw a t-shirt with Black Luigi on it. He was, like, jumping on turtles, but he had a gold chain, you know? It was a whole
same thing. Same guy. Same guy.
Yeah, same guy.
So Lucien Conin leads the... So the DEA at the time functions like this. Imagine a beat cop who wanders around and asks for drug dealers to give him drugs.
So Port of Call, New Orleans. Okay.
The DEA would then take that drug dealer, interrogate him, try to get answers. And if they didn't, they just said, aw, shucks, and kept on. They functioned identically to your local PD.
So they just bought drugs, tried to get questions answered, and then they just kept going.
Yeah.
So now you have, like, no arrests, but a ton of drugs.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Lucien Cunningham changes all of this system, except for the having tons of drugs piled up.
Probably more.
Yeah, absolutely. Lucien Cunningham comes out of the OSS and then CIA. And he goes to the DEA, and he's like, you guys run this like dog shit. I'm telling you right now, what you need is two CIA agents, and we could revolutionize this whole fucking process. We're going to show you all how to build wide-ranging intel networks. We're going to win. At the time, they're like ramping up the war on drugs under Nixon, and he's like, hey, Tricky Dick, do I have an offer for you, baby? I'm going to stop the war on drugs because we're going to win it. Nixon is just like, sure. Puts him in charge of the special services at the DEA. At this point, the DEA is considered like a retirement job. Like if you were an FBI agent who was really good, you wanted to coast out the last couple years of your career, you take a small pay cut, go to the DEA, and you fuck off.
Because the FBI, I think even by this point, has a mandatory retirement age of like 56.
Yes.
Something like that.
Conan is like, all of those guys need to go. Listen up, Grandpa. You need to fucking beat it. Starts replacing them with CIA agents. So, like, at this point, Verbel gets included in the DEA with Lucien Cunningham. So we have a dude who is sworn into the Corsican Mafia, and a man who, by his own admission, when he was doing work in China, once got paid for a job with 10 pounds of opium, which he then sold, again, by his own admission. And these men are now in charge of the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Well, I don't think he was paid in opium so he could do it, so it makes sense.
Conan uses the Corsican Mafia to build ties with Gulbuddin and Hekmatyar. Because again, like his first, you know, Sincere Wolf loves to say that once in the CIA, always in the CIA.
Yeah.
That is
excellent pension plan is what the point of that is, I think.
That is certainly what Lucien Cunningham truly believes, is that once you are in the CIA, you are always in the CIA. This is the closest you'll ever get to seeing Laura on camera. Right, baby? What? This is the closest we get to seeing you on camera for real.
Oh, that wave. She's done.
Yeah, she is. Give me She's one second.
Fed. She is fed. You show off Laura like you show off your cat. That's insane. Or like how I show off my cat. A bunch of empty air going to be here because Mike's moving to the quiet room. Anyways. So this has been a fun story so far. We are currently at 2:37 on the recording. This has been Haydn DePriest. I am... You can follow me on Twitter. If you were watching the video, I've got the at right there. At Collapsarian. Collapsarian. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast. Make sure to subscribe to us on YouTube or on Twitch. Follow us on Twitter at Sycamore_Timber. Send us fan mail through the DMs so that we can read it live on stream and make fun of you. Because we're always looking for people to make fun of on the podcast. We want to engage with the viewers in an entertaining way. I have been asked. I am getting a text message, which means I am probably in trouble. Oh, nope, never mind. Let's see what this is. I'm really good. Recommend it, please. Who could kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators if they're red. Fucking a man. Doo, doo. CIA man. Who could train gorillas by the dozen? Send them off to kill their untrained cousin. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can find a counter agent quick? Especially the ones themselves of it. Fucking amen. It's my cat. CIA man. Who can plan a ride in Vietnam? Who can mine the harbors, Nicaragua? Out hit all the hitmen of Chicago. Fucking amen. CIA man. I didn't hear that, but sure.
Haydn agrees.
I do.
And his last name is DePriest.
That's true.
So you can trust him because he's DePriest.
Yeah. The priest has never done anything unsavory.
Priests have never done anything unsavory, Hayes just said, Laura.
You can trust with your children.
I think he said you trust them with your children. I am trying to convince Laura to convert to Catholicism.
Why? What are you hoping to get out of this?
She wants a child. She wants our children to be baptized.
You can baptize them and still be Protestant. Is fine. But if you're going to have them baptized, I guess, yeah, why not do the Catholic one? Like, you know that the Catholic and Protestant churches, they recognize each other's baptisms.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do.
It depends on the Protestant church.
Yes, it does, but in general.
Yeah, Laura goes to, like, a hippy-dippy jingle-jangle guitar church.
I'm sure they that means they're going to they'll probably recognize fucking Mormon baptisms, dude. If it's a hippie jingle jangle, they don't really care. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but the Catholic Church won't recognize theirs.
I'm sure they will, as long as as long as it's a church that's in communion.
They aren't.
Does Laura care what kind of baptism it is?
Yeah.
Why?
Because she's a little bit religious.
Like, as long as so Catholic's not good enough, then?
No, Catholic is good enough.
Well, then just do Catholic. Just baptize them as Catholic.
Well, she would want to convert if we did that. Because she knows that's the only way she's getting me to a church. Because if you think I'm sitting through an hour of Protestant preaching every week.
You could do Lutheran.
She won't do that.
You could do Anglican.
It's just Catholic, but with divorce.
Yes.
And Lutheran is just Catholic, but more anti-Semitic.
Which is a solid feat on their part, to be honest.
Impressive moves from Martin Luther. So back to what we were talking about. The U.S. builds these connections between Lucy and Conan's old boys, Corsican Mafia, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. They smuggle the drugs through Afghanistan, out through the Balkans, and up to Corsica. I assume that for most of this, smuggling is not super difficult. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if it counts as smuggling within Afghanistan's borders. I feel like you have to have, like, a functional government to smuggle against.
Yeah, probably.
And again, much like the airline, you're competing against no one. So,
sorry, I'm getting lost. We've been gone for too long. Let's get back on track.
Is that how you do that?
Do what?
Yeah. Okay. So, Lucy and Conan develops these ties for the CIA to develop the ability of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar to be able to push out drugs.
And these are being trafficked internationally?
Yes.
Which markets are these hitting?
So the Corsican Mafia primarily transmits to Europe and then to the U.S. via the Italian mobs. Or Canada via the Italian mobs. You know, North America.
To North America. So it's hitting Europe and then North America. Through a series of, like, these little agents of distribution.
Yes. So Golbludin Hekmatyar becomes part of what is and will be seen throughout our podcasts to be a wider developed ring of organized crime tied to right-wing terror. By developing this connection, we kind of develop all of the others that are to come. But Lucien Conin plays a key position in the development of the origins of this drug trade. So stay tuned for when we talk about Operation Condor at some point.
Do we need to release the trailer once this episode drops?
Probably.
Okay. That'll be in a couple weeks.
Because after...
From when we record this. We're recording this on September 27th.
So from here we have next time, right? Because we are approaching our 3-hour mark and things go downhill from there for us.
Yeah, probably. I was about to ask. I want to get some dinner, so...
From here, next week, on the next exciting episode of Timber Sycamore,
we will be discussing the Civil War, right?
Soviet pullout and the Civil War a little bit.
Okay, so we want to do a little bit more Phase 4. That's fine.
Because Phase 4 we didn't touch on as much as we probably should have.
Yeah, fair enough.
So we'll finish up Phase 4, and then we'll be introducing the Civil War and the reconciliation government. And then the 96-01 government, and we'll probably be stopping there.
I think that's good. Leaving right off with 9/11.
Yeah,
we'll let all the other leftist podcasts touch Afghanistan at that point. I'm sure there's plenty of them.
So thank you for tuning in to another exciting edition of Timber Sycamore.
It's been a joy having you. I'm Hayden DePriest,
and I'm Michael Petroselli.